The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. This week, we've got another story from Civics 101, New Hampshire, our local look at how state government works. Today, we're looking at the governor. Ben Henry has the story.
Outside the New Hampshire State House, next to the road, there's a low granite wall. Good place to sit, except on snowy days like today. About 90 years ago, during the Great Depression, people would sit here and ask for money from passersby. And there's a story that the governor of New Hampshire at the time, John Gilbert Wynant, would walk by this wall every day and he would hand out money. That might be just a story, but the point is, Wynant was that kind of guy. The state was in a crisis, and not just an economic one. It was an identity crisis. The mills that once drove the economy could no longer compete with mills in the South. Farms in New Hampshire had long been outcompeted by farms in the Midwest. State government was not running smoothly. We had 52 different state agencies, which is crazy given how small the state government was. All these agencies were tangled up with each other, their responsibilities overlapped, it was very confusing. Something had to be done. And Wynant realized he, the governor, was the only person who could do it. So John Wynant, in the bleakest years of the Depression, asked a think tank, the Brookings Institution, to advise him how to make the government more efficient. First thing, they said, way too many agencies, consolidate them. Way too many boards and commissions, get rid of them. Next, they said, empower the state government to audit town budgets. In other words, give the state more financial influence over towns. Wynant took that advice and reorganized the whole state government. He transformed it from the type of small and weak state government that was common in the 19th century into a more powerful government that could cope with the industries and the bureaucracies and the demands of the 20th century. He also rewrote his own job description. Previous New Hampshire governors all worked part-time. There just wasn't that much for an executive to do in a small government. Wynant came in all day, every day. Eventually, he moved on to bigger and better things.
The newly appointed American ambassador to Britain, Mr. John G. Wynant, arrives in England.
But his legacy lived on in New Hampshire. I want to talk today about the powers that the governor has with somebody who has just buckets of knowledge about New Hampshire history and politics.
Okay, I'm R. Stuart Wallace. I've been director of the State Historical Society and director of the Division of Historical Resources, and I'm currently full-time faculty at NHTI, Concord's Community College, where I teach history courses, particularly New Hampshire history courses.
Almost anyone in New Hampshire can be the governor. As long as you've lived here at least 7 years and you are at least 30 years old, you can run for governor.
Well, the governor and his five-member council head up the executive branch.
If you win that election, you now have a lot of new powers, but there are two main powers. The first one is that you get to write the first draft of the state budget. And we talked about this in our two-part episode about the state budget. The governor gets the conversation started, then legislators are the ones who hammer out the final details. So overall, the governor only has moderate influence over the whole budget process. But they can veto the budget if they really don't like it. In most other states, the governor vetoes individual pieces of the budget, which is called a line item veto. But not in New Hampshire. Here, it's all or nothing. If you want to veto one thing in the budget, you have to scrap the whole thing. So it's inconvenient to do, and it looks bad, and the governor does not do this very often. Speaking of vetoes, it's not just the budget. The governor can veto any piece of new legislation.
Every governor has their own style, however. Some governors basically are somewhat more laid back and let the legislature do their thing. Other governors get heavily involved in the legislative process, making sure that the various committees that are deciding on amendments and changes in legislation know what the governor will or will not accept. This way the legislature knows beforehand what's likely to get vetoed or what is not.
The second main power the governor has is to nominate people for important positions within the government, like the commissioners that lead state agencies. There's a catch, though. The executive branch of the New Hampshire government is not overseen by just the governor. It's also overseen by an executive council. So after the governor nominates somebody, they need to get the approval of the 5-person executive council.
And what the council does is they have divided the state into 5 regions by population.
1 council member per region.
And their job is to approve appointments and approve contracts. And that's not just appointments to the top spots. It's appointments to all of these various bodies that we have out there. I don't know that anybody loses any sleep over the next appointment to taxidermy councils or what have you, but some of those appointments are ripe plums. And as a result, the council has clout, and some of those appointments are politically motivated.
Like with most of the stuff that the governor does, the council can shut it down if they want.
That by itself is very unusual. Other governors, with 1 or 2 exceptions, have no council, and their councils have no powers.
New Hampshire's governor is probably the weakest executive in the entire country. It goes way back to the roots of our state government. Almost as long as we've had a governor, we've had an executive council looking over their shoulder. We are also 1 out of only 2 states in which the governor has just a 2-year term rather than 4.
And so they're running for re-election the day they're inaugurated.
2 years just isn't very much time to get stuff done. Although, here's a plot twist, New Hampshire voters almost always elect their governor to a 2nd term. Since the 1930s, only 2 governors lost their first re-election. Possibly 2 years isn't enough time to get tired of somebody. Now, although the governor has pretty limited power in a practical sense, if you check out the state constitution, there is a lot of stuff they're allowed to do but don't actually do. They can declare a state of emergency.
Here in New Hampshire, we have lucked out. No tsunamis, no huge fires. Our floods tend to be small and local, so we haven't had too many problems here.
They can pardon someone of a crime. They usually need support from the executive council to do that. They are also New Hampshire's commander-in-chief. They could raise an army if we were to ever go to war as a state, which realistically won't happen unless we decide to invade Massachusetts, which we might do. So those are the powers that are written down in the Constitution and in law about what the governor can do. But there are other kinds of power. There's soft power. The governor is the most prominent public figure in the state. If they want the voters or the legislature or the courts to start thinking about an issue, all they have to do is talk about it.
Governors jump in with both feet. Governors have gotten involved heavily in the opioid crisis or homelessness and homeless shelter issues.
The State of the State speech is a prime example of the governor's built-in platform.
I don't know that many people actually watched the State of the State speech.
New Hampshire has among the highest rates in the country of drug and alcohol abuse and dependence.
Our mission to reverse the terrible effects of this epidemic, it rests on our ability to embrace a spirit of cooperation, innovation, compassion.
But ranks at the bottom in accessing treatment.
What department heads try to do and various advocacy groups and lobbyists try to do is to get a good line or two in the governor's speech. Because then what they've done is they've hooked the governor, if you will, as is committed to helping with better roads or opioid crisis or better early childhood education or whatever they throw into the speech. That adds some clout to future legislation.
One of the little perks to being a governor is you get a mansion. It's known as the Bridges House. It is 21 Mountain Road on the outskirts of Concord, sort of the White House of New Hampshire. It's not white, it's made of brick. It's also not really a mansion. It's got 2 bedrooms. Most governors don't actually choose to live there. Hopefully they stay 1 or 2 nights there whenever they're feeling fancy.
Coming up after a break, a thought experiment from Outside In. Welcome back to Word of Mouth. I'm Erica Janik. Here's a humdinger of a thought experiment. How fast could people go before the combustion engine and other technologies drastically increase the speed of the human race? That's the question in our next story from Outside In.
So we are all in the studio here today with Nick Capodice.
Hey, Sam.
Co-host of Civics 101, one of NHPR's other podcasts. So, Nick, we're here because we have been vigorously debating a question that you presented to us at one point.
Yeah, it's a question that I've had that my friends and I have debated for about 20 to 25 years.
It's like every time you come together, the friendship just picks up where it left off.
It's just if it's late enough in the night and somebody throws this question out, then we just do it, you know.
Okay.
So the question is this. Before planes, before cars, what is the fastest that a human being could go?
Trains?
Before trains.
Before engines?
Before engines. Before all the fast stuff happened. Before we got real fast. What was the fastest a human being went? What was the situation? Now, there's some rules. We're not counting falling.
You can't count falling?
You can't count falling. If you just fall off a cliff. So that's pretty much the only rule is no falling.
Horses?
Horses can count. I'll go with horses counting. The things I'm thinking about are faster than a horse.
Oh. So no falling and no advanced mechanical
internal
movement.
Combustion.
Yeah, you got it.
What if you were eaten by a tiger and then the tiger was running? Would that count? Do you have to be alive to be moving fast?
I think that consciousness is an important part of existence.
Fine.
Can it be multiple people working together to move fast?
It certainly can. Should I say my hypothesis?
Okay, what we got? I'm going to write these down.
So my hypothesis is the Nantucket sleigh ride.
What's the Nantucket sleigh ride?
Yeah, what's that?
When you harpoon a whale and then your whaling ship is tugged along in a vast speed by one of these beautiful leviathans of the deep. That's my argument is that's the fastest a human went.
Well, all right. How fast do whales
I'm
go?
I have to research this. I'm from Nantucket. I bet it's when the sperm whale dove down when it was trying to get rid of the whaling harpoon ship by like going into the deep, and I bet the fastest they were going was when they were going down and drowning.
When they sounded.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never thought about that.
But you mentioned something that makes me think that you said sleigh ride, and I think snow has enabled people to go very fast over the course of history. And so I would be curious to investigate how fast people have used either skis, skates, sleds. I bet people hit some real top speeds that way.
I don't know, though, because like, if you look at early skis, they were not speedy.
Olympic skiers go, what, 80, 90 miles an hour?
Yeah. But that's on, like, a prepared surface. Old school skiing, they were going through, like, deep snow.
Okay, fine. But do you think whales go faster than...
Well, I don't know how fast a whale goes.
I think a whale goes faster than a horse.
What about an ostrich? That's immediately what I thought. Someone riding an ostrich.
Swiss Family Robinson.
But then I also asked about many people working together because I wondered about Polynesians in boats rowing together.
Boats go fast.
Yeah.
Team rowing.
Yeah. Is the supposition that like team rowing is going to be the fastest boat?
I feel like it would be.
Yeah.
Unassisted by chemistry.
I would think a small sailboat with a powerful sail could get you going faster than a big boat.
Some of the fastest, like hydrofoils now, what do they go? Like 60 miles an hour?
They move.
They're crazy.
I would also count swinging as locomotion.
Swinging.
Yeah. So you don't have to discount falling just because if you're holding on to something, if you're tethered by something.
That feels like falling to me. Like someone must have made a massive swing a very long time ago.
Because falling would be specific gravity, like the fastest that a mass can fall, like it gets to a certain point with like air resistance. Terminal velocity. There's a term for that. So swinging would not reach terminal velocity.
No. But even so, just like if you just have a long rope and a tall thing and jump off holding it, that's basically falling. And then the swing stops you before you hit terminal velocity. Yes, but like you got to be going faster than a whale.
I don't know.
Nick says no. All right, if you say swings are allowed, my friend,
I'm letting swings in.
All right.
Also, I don't know if anyone's ever been flung out of a catapult, But that's one that maybe you should consider. Maybe you should consider a catapult.
Indeed.
Or a trebuchet, which is much better than a catapult.
Well, in that case, can we also include other sorts of purposeful falling, like being shot out of a cannon or going down a Niagara Falls in a barrel?
If you can find evidence that someone was ever actually shot out of a cannon that survived before circuses, I think you should just, you know, shun the technology as opposed to...
The spirit of the question.
The spirit of the question. Thank you. We can't get bogged down in the letter of the law.
Isn't this exactly what happens during your conversations? Yeah. Is you get bogged down in the letter of the law? Because you know, technology is so cannons, for example.
Taylor, my point is that no one has ever actually shot out of a cannon in the circus. Okay, in the circus, I thought it was like a springboard that they like.
Oh, really?
It's not really. They're not really firing a cannon.
Oh, really?
You'd die. You'd be burned to death.
Well, but like maybe I don't know. I don't know what I thought was happening.
Okay.
All right.
Investigate.
Okay, I'm ready. Are you all ready?
I'm ready.
My whale.
Okay. So, everyone's done their research?
Yes. Yeah.
I think that we should start with mine because I'm the host. No, because...
Oh my God, power hungry.
I think we should start with horses because they are obviously and demonstrably very fast, and we definitely rode them. Seems like you gotta beat horses. If you can't beat horses, then you're nothing.
That seems fair.
Do we still have the same horses around that we had back in the day?
Ooh. Interesting question, Justine. So to figure this out, I called an archaeologist named Sandra Olson. She's with the University of Kansas. She has spent her entire life studying what is believed to be the first domestication of horses, which was?
Right. So the Batai culture dates to around 5,500 years ago, and it's located in north central Kazakhstan.
So that's when we first domesticated horses, 5,500 years ago. They have a veritable boatload of archaeological evidence showing that this is the earliest known site. There are leather tack. There are huge amounts of horse bones and middens. There's manure in the roofing materials. There's remains of fences. And, of course, mare's milk in pottery.
Nobody would, in their right mind, would milk a wild mare because, you know, the wild horses were probably quite a lot to contend with.
Good way to get kicked in the head.
Yeah, yeah.
Obviously, 5,500 years ago, Justine's question is the apt one. Is this the same horse? Now, I don't think we have to actually limit ourselves to the Batai horse because obviously people started breeding horses for speed and we had faster horses much before the steam engine.
Yeah.
However, even if we stick with just the Batai horse, they were pretty darn fast.
You know, this has really got me thinking. So based on the size of the animal, I would say certainly they weren't the fastest horse compared to modern day breeds, but they were about the size of a quarter horse, which of course quarter horses are a little more gracile, a little more delicate, and they are known for their speed. They can go about 55 miles per hour in short sprints.
Whoa.
Now these horses, I think, would have been more durable. They would have been slower, maybe 45 to 50 miles an hour, but able to just keep going forever.
Wow, that's fast.
That is fast.
I should have just Googled how fast does a horse go.
Episode over.
No. I think they're beatable.
Oh, thank goodness, because I would be very sad if, like, horses were, there it is, horses.
Did she describe them as gracile?
Gracile, graceful.
Oh.
Long of leggy.
I thought it meant like grassy in the meadows.
Me too. I'm glad I asked because I was just like, what?
And I've got one last clip that this might get cut entirely, but I just like it so much so you guys get to hear it.
But I've seen some pretty remarkable things at Kazakh horse races. Of course, this is with a saddle, but they will ride at full gallop and the rider will go past his body underneath the belly of the horse and back up at full gallop. I don't know how that works. I've seen it, and it's surprising to me.
The Comanches did that, too. Like, there's stories of, like, the Native American riding cultures shooting from underneath the belly of the horse, using the horse as a shield. It's, yeah,
incredible.
I believe that.
Can I just go back and ask, why was there poop on the roofs? What were they doing? Just tossing it up there? Like, this poop is on the streets. Throw it on the roofs.
That's a good question. I don't know.
I feel like it would be a good, like, insulator, like, holding things together.
She did say insulation, but... But then as Taylor asked the question, I was like, really?
It's basically just grass.
Okay.
Well, so that's
that's the mark to beat, isn't it?
The mark to beat.
Horses.
Who's next?
Oh, it's me.
Oh, Justine, you got to help me out.
So, Nick.
Yeah.
Your theory was the Nantucket sleigh ride.
Yeah, when a whale is made fast to a whaling boat, and then the whale sounds, and dives below, and then it scoots off and drags the whale ship behind it.
Yep.
I thought that was the fastest.
All right, so the Nantucket sleigh ride. People have been whaling for a long time. It is not just Nantucket and New Bedford. They also is Japan and across the Arctic Circle and the Basque since prehistoric times. But we are going to focus on Yankee whaling here because this specific sleigh ride did come from Yankee whaling. So in between the 1600s and the end of the 19th century, Japanese traditional whaling used nets and surrounding and herding the whales, and like Basques hunted right whales and bowhead whales, which are both slow. So the Yankee whalers hunted sperm whales. And that's what sperm whales sound like. Those clicks are so loud that they can paralyze your hand if you're in the water. They're like one of the loudest animals on Earth. So anyway.
What? Just like the vibrations?
Yeah. So the whale ships, many of them out of Nantucket. But since the Nantucket Whaling Museum was closed this month, I had to call the New Bedford Whaling Museum. Michael Dyer, he's the curator of maritime history at the New Bedford Whaling Museum. And I think I actually interrupted him in the middle of a train of thought when I called him.
How do you do, Justine?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, I'm trying to figure out who built the Russo and when.
The Russo's a whale ship. He was all despondent about it.
Hey, we all have our jobs to do.
And I was like, well, it must be kind of hard fact-checking something that happened, you know, centuries ago.
Well, you know, it isn't. Especially when it comes to American maritime history and whaling history, is absolutely an extraordinarily well-documented. We could tell you the eye color of the people who sailed on any given ship out of New Bedford in the 1840s.
So I was like, well, you'll absolutely be able to help me figure out how fast the Nantucket sleigh ride was.
Well, yes and no, because one of the real tough bits about that is the amount of disinformation, misinformation, disagreement, conversation that took place among whalemen as to exactly how fast they were going.
I imagine that like a whale ship had to be like a really bro-y environment, don't you think?
If fishermen exaggerate,
right,
then whalers must like really exaggerate.
Certainly. But happily, the New Bedford Whaling Museum has like thousands of logbooks kept on ships and other primary materials in their archives. And so there's like a canon of like a dozen or so like whaling documents. And one of them was written in 1874 by William Morris Davis. It's a book called Nimrod of the Sea. And in this book, he says that sperm whales could go
for a very short spurt. A sperm whale could tow a whaleboat at about 20 or 25 miles an hour.
But the thing is, this short spurt thing is really important because sperm whales are sprinters. And there's this other government document that Mike pulled out, the Fisheries and the Fishery Industries of the United States, published in 1887. And they're kind of doubtful of this 20 to 25 miles number.
They write in here, 20 or 25 miles per hour is rather a high estimate of the speed of a whale.
So, Nick, are you ready for this? I'm about to really let you down.
I can't go any lower, but that's
his eyes have been cringing. And
they have.
Yeah. So this next part, he says in this same document, it's written that a sperm whale could do this.
Sperm whales have been known to run out 300 fathoms of line in 4 minutes.
300 fathoms, 1,800 feet. So you can actually calculate this out.
It was figured that six to 10 miles per hour sort of was a Nantucket sleigh rod. Oh,
that's so slow.
Don't keep going.
And actually, you calculate it out and it actually goes to like 5.66 miles an hour. Aww. So 6 to 10 miles is even generous.
I can walk that quickly.
But Mike did throw a caveat.
But the big unknown here is the fin whale. And that is a big unknown.
So the fin whale was not really hunted in Yankee whaling usually because it's open ocean. It's an open ocean creature. It doesn't school the same way sperm whales do, and it's very, very fast.
Ooh, sounds fast.
So he says,
every once in a while, a Yankee whaleman would get fast to a fin whale, and those things can swim, you know, at 50 miles an hour.
50 miles an hour. As fast as a horse.
Tide.
Yeah, tide.
Fast to a fin whale.
I could not find any other corroboration of this, by the way. The fin whale, I think this is a stretch. I think that what's cool about a fin whale is it can cruise around 20 or 23 miles an hour, and it can sprint up to 30 or so. So we're gonna have to fact check this, and we might have to cut this.
Well, we don't have to cut it. We can just say, like, we can leave it as a tantalizing thing that is completely uncorroborated and...
All right.
Because look at Nick's face when you said that.
I know.
No, but it's okay. It's okay. Did you guys know that intrepid Yankee whalers would go below the belly of a whale during a whale hunt and then back to the top again?
And what? Shoot from underneath. Just try.
So I would say that the Nantucket Sleigh Ride has been defeated, in my opinion.
I it did much better than I thought, though. The fin whale twist, you know, I was not expecting the fin whale twist.
Yeah, all the kids are doing the fin whale twist.
So what's next?
Boats?
Boats.
So I just want to say, the boats is probably not going to win, but I think that I can impress you. So first, the Polynesians, 2,000 years ago, explorers from Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, they set out to explore 10 million square miles of ocean in canoes with twin hulls, outriggers, and full sails. They were great navigators. Captain Cook, great explorer, traveled around the world. He estimated that a Tongan canoe could sail 3 miles to our two.
Captain Cook was the one who popularized calling them canoes as a way to trivialize them.
It is true.
Why would that trivialize it?
Because it's just a canoe. It's just a canoe. when like you see these things and they're huge and like two dozen people are sleeping on them.
So warthogs in the Polynesian Islands are called Captain Cookers. And I think that's fit. That's an apt ending to a man who did such horrible things.
It's a sick burn. Yeah.
So then on the other side of the world, or around the same time, if you're in Europe and you spotted some ships on the horizon in the 800s or 900s, they were probably Viking ships. And, you know, if you're just a regular monk, you know, you're just illuminating some manuscripts, you see a ship on the horizon and you're like, that looks dangerous, but I know I've got a couple hours because, you know, that ship has to drop anchor, then they're going to row to shore or they have to find a harbor. But if it is, in fact, a Viking ship, that is not true.
Their ship technology was better than much anyone else in Europe. So they could go places no one else could go. And there's two reasons for that. One is the ships could sail very close to the wind, so they could sail more into the wind than other ships, allowing them to go places even if the wind was not favorable. And the other thing is they had very, very shallow drafts, so they could sail even though the water was not very deep, which meant that these warships could sail very far upriver and make raids where they were completely unexpected. And they didn't need a pier or a dock or anything else. You could just sail it up onto a sandy beach, jump off the bow, and they'd be ready to fight.
So you wouldn't even have time to finish a cherub on your illuminated manuscript. Yeah. Oh.
The letter O.
So that was Dr. Bill Short. He's the author of several books on Vikings, and he has a specialty in Viking combat. So the Viking ships are moving really fast in these special boats that can go basically anywhere. And these ships often looked like dragons. Here's the entry from the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle from 793 on the first Viking raid on Lindisfarne, which is a holy island off the northeast coast of England. They wrote, "Here were dreadful forewarnings come over the land of Northumbria and woefully terrified the people. These were amazing sheets of lightning and whirlwinds, and fiery dragons were seen flying in the sky." It's terrifying.
It is terrifying.
But I haven't heard how fast these things
go. Yeah, it seems like we're dancing around something here.
Yeah, doing the Viking dance.
How fast were they going? Well, Bill told me that he's actually participated in a number of rowing experiments in recreated longships, and he said that they were able to go comfortably about 3.2 knots.
So what's
that's
a knot?
Like less than 10 miles an hour, though, huh?
Yes.
okay.
No, the warships are mostly rowed because that's how they can, you know, get close to whoever they want to attack. But they also had sails on board these ships, and they also had cargo ships. And I asked him how fast these boats could travel. And
it depends who you ask. So it seems like something like 10 to 12 knots is not not unbelievable under wind power. And some people believe that, you know, even 20 plus knots is possible under the most ideal conditions. And then a final anecdote. There was a Viking ship that sailed across the Atlantic some years ago, and the skipper is someone I have met. He told me that one day just conditions were just wonderful, so they all said, why not? Let's see how fast this ship really will go. And he said he got 30-plus knots, according to the GPS, which is just unbelievable.
Again, I don't know what a knot is.
I can give you the, let me look, quickly look it up. I didn't write down the 30.
I feel like we need a drum roll.
That is 35 miles per hour.
Oh.
It's still pretty, faster than a sperm whale.
It would be scary to be on a boat going 35 miles an hour.
If we're just talking about boats without regard to time period, then the fastest sailing record was set in 2012, and that boat was going 65.45 knots, which is 75 miles per hour.
Ooh, that's one of those newfangled fancy.
That's a fancy boat.
Is that hydrofoil?
Yes. Mm. But the thing that I think is really cool and why I told you about Polynesians and Vikings is that they were sailing at speeds that are as fast, if not faster, than your average regular boat today.
Yeah, they didn't have fiberglass in Polynesia.
Exactly.
Speaking of hydrofoils, I have another thing to add to the boat discussion. Can I add this?
Yeah.
There's another kind of boat that I wanted to explore, which is the ice boat.
Ice boats.
Well, I'm Bob Dill, live in Burlington, Vermont, and I designed and built two different ice boats.
It's basically like a boat with ice blades on it. So there's three points of contact, and it's...
Two in the back, one in the front?
Two in the front, one in the back, and the back is the steering. Mm.
And in a conventional water boat, they're constrained by having to move the boat through the water. With an ice boat, the main constraint is the aerodynamic drag that's created by the boat. So making the boat go fast has a lot to do making the aerodynamic drag as low as possible.
I actually have a picture.
What's it look like? It just looks like a bunch of like two by fours with a sail. And then on the bottom of the two by fours are skates.
Bob is an ice boater himself.
Fairly early into getting into ice boating, I realized that there was a lot of folklore about how fast they'd gone.
People say, oh, they go 100 miles an hour all the time.
And it just didn't make sense. So I bought a radar gun and started going to regattas. And of course, nobody was going 100 miles an hour. People with the fastest boats were barely getting over 80, which is still very fast, don't get me wrong.
So some of the fastest ice boats go like 80 miles an hour.
Wow.
In our first phone call, Bob Dill told me he spent 35 years trying to figure out this question of how fast ice boats could have gone and how fast they can go now. So ice boats were first invented in Holland in the 1700s, the mid-1700s. What's it like to ride an ice boat, an antique ice boat?
They're very exciting to ride in. They have an instability they call a flicker, which occasionally spins the boat and often throws some of the passengers out of the boat at the same time.
How thrilling.
Whee!
How fast do you think those antique ice boats could have gone in the 1700s and 1800s?
I think the ice boats that were sailing back in the real early days of ice boating were probably sailing at 30 or 40 miles an hour when they were sailing in Holland, for example. And I don't have a lot of data, there isn't a lot of data, but looking at the configuration, how the boats were built, they weren't really designed for high speeds. By the early 1900s, late 1800s, they were probably doing 50, maybe 60 miles an hour.
So this is the question, do they count that late in the game? Do we have ice boats at 50, 60 miles an hour?
I think Nick's the referee here.
Oh gosh, I mean, what's the year one more time?
The sort of heyday of the Hudson Valley ice boat scene was 1870 to 1900 or so.
I think ice boats kind of nudges into that modern era.
Yeah.
It's sort of like when did we transition to this newer, more slippery, faster ice boat? And does that feel like the same thing as transitioning into the combustion engine era?
It sort of does to me.
Well, another wrinkle, I will say, because I was curious about the timing of different things, is that the first quote-unquote automobile that was used with a steam engine was invented in like the 1700s.
Yeah, but those didn't go very fast.
No, correct. But that's the measure. So if we're arguing about if it's when things started going fast, the mid-1800s, I think, is legit, because at that point, cars still sucked.
I'd just like to dwell for a second, though, on the fact that ice boats went go 80 miles an hour, just like recreational ice boaters.
That's terrifying. More from Outside In after a break.
Okay, folks, welcome back to Outside In. Today, we are taking on Nick Capodice's friendly thought experiment. What was the fastest speed achieved by a human body before people started zipping around in cars and airplanes and what have you? There are two rules. You can't die, and falling doesn't count. Okay, Taylor, you're up.
So real quickly, before I get into what I think was a contender, but based off our conversation, maybe isn't, I'll just talk about skis for a second, because we mentioned it before, and I knew that skis go way back, and this is crazy. Who would have known? Skis go further back than domesticated horses.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, well, Sam wasn't surprised, but I was. The earliest documented evidence of skiing goes back 10,000 years. There's a cave painting in the Altai Mountains of China. Now, these are traditions that were passed down from generation to generation. They are now being lost to modernity. But Mongols and Kazakhs in this area have been, like I said, passing it down. And this ancient method of skiing looks a little bit different. So instead of two poles, they have like one big pole. So they almost look like a Venetian
gondolier.
Yeah, yeah. So they use that sort of as a rudder, and they lean way back on these long wooden skis that have animal hair sort of on the bottom, so that way they can walk upwards if they're going uphill and then ski down.
That's amazing. Yeah, because the animal hair goes one way and it doesn't go the other.
That's why they call the things you put on modern backcountry skis skins.
Oh my
God. You just skin up the hill on these like modern microfibers.
This is delightful.
Yeah. And one of the things when I first started looking at this, which felt promising, is those cave paintings show them hunting ibex. So I'm thinking, all right, if they're hunting a fast animal, they must be going pretty quick. Luckily, I got to outsource pretty much all of the research here to National Geographic. They did a big story on this a few years back.
Which is great. I recommend it to everybody.
It's a good story. And they went out, they saw how the skis were crafted, and they went hunting with some of the people that are still doing this.
I was always trying to stay ahead of the curve somehow, to do photography. Try to get position, try to get past them, try to get to good angles. We found that we had quite a hard time keeping up with them.
The thing is that you're right, Sam. They're going through really deep snow, and they are moving. I would say, like, just visually, they might be going 20, 25 miles an hour, which is really fast considering these are, like, completely wild mountains. They're skiing in between trees, but it doesn't seem capable of even coming close to some of the records we've talked about. And in fact, the hunting of the ibex, the reason it works is because the ibex are in, like, chest-deep snow and are barely moving, and they surround them on the skis and then lasso them. So I would say that we can pretty much totally rule out skiing as an option. However, I did start digging into ice, like you, Justine, and that is when I came upon a very different story.
Ooh.
But I think around 1900, I always thought that the Cresta Riders were the fastest men on Earth. Well, I'm Stephen Bartley, and I'm the honorary archivist for the St. Moritz Tobogganing Club.
I don't know if you caught that. That is the St. Moritz Tobogganing Club.
Tobogganing Club.
So, you know, I mean, ice skates, fast. Skis, you know, pretty fast. Sledding. Who here thought sledding had a chance of winning this contest?
Sledding's for children.
Sledding sounds like it's for children, but apparently there's races going back to the 15th century in Scandinavian countries. In the 1870s, there was a big technological change. It's not a huge shift, but they started making them steerable. And these are sort of like the little... I mean, it's like a little toboggan with a wooden top and metal runners, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Mm. Back in the 1870s, people were racing down the streets of this place in Switzerland called St. Moritz. It's in the Alps, so it's got these like long, crazy streets. And people were like crashing into stuff and literally causing disruption. So they kind of gave them a place to do this, and they started deliberately icing this long chute. It was kind of like a slide.
This isn't sledding, this is the luge.
Yes.
So they had to shoot down this hill, and then you ended up going over the lake. And if you got up enough speed, you could go right across the lake, which is probably about two-thirds of a mile across. But quite a few people got injured because they would sort of be going so fast, and if they sort of got it slightly wrong, they'd sort of fall, you know, go over the side of the path before hitting the lake. And, Charles Darwin's son was nearly killed doing that, apparently.
And that's where the Darwin Awards came from.
Not messing around. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously, people were going pretty fast, just like launching down this chute. At this point, this is just ice. Like, it's not super well constructed or anything. But in 1884 or 5, a handful of guys built something called the Cresta, which is pretty much at this point the world's oldest well-documented ice track. And it is basically a much rougher version of what you would see at the Olympics for luge or bobsled or skeleton.
It was sort of natural. Basically, it was a natural formation combined with a footpath. And then in order to make the life a bit more interesting, they added a couple of major corners. It's about 3/4 mile long. And it gets built from scratch every year. It's not an artificial track.
All they do is sculpt it from snow and then pour buckets of water over it, and it freezes, and it turns into basically a luge track.
Yeah. That feels like pretty clearly within these fuzzy rules.
Yeah.
From the technological standpoint.
And the spirit, too, I feel like.
How fast, though, Taylor? We didn't get a... do you have a number on this?
Well, this became an annual thing pretty much right away. And I should say that pretty much everybody doing this were, like, wealthy British folks who would vacation in St. Moritz and try their hand at the Cresta. They started doing organized races. And then finally, in 1897, we have our first documented speed trial. And they actually used electric contacts placed a certain distance away at the fastest parts of the tracks so that they could see when they were hitting both of those contacts and then calculate the speed. And?
In 1897, I think, is the first reference. A speed of 68 miles per hour was recorded.
68?
Wow.
Oh.
1900, speed of 73 miles per hour was recorded.
Oh,
wow.
And so here is what I submit to you, is that I have in my hands actual notes and documentation of hitting the 73 miles per hour. It's hard to read because it's like old school. It's like super cursive. I think they should have a name for this kind of writing.
But this is really interesting because this is the first time they recorded the speed.
Correct.
But they could have been going that fast for a while.
They could have, although to the point that Erica made earlier about the fact that we've have all this technology, but for the most part, we don't go that much faster. What's crazy is that the record today, you know, over 100 years later, is 82 miles per hour. Hmm. And that is held by an Irish skeleton racer who's been in the Olympics. His name is Lord Clifton Rotsley.
Still just fancy British folks doing this sport.
They're the worst. They banned women from 1923 until this year.
What? Of course they did.
And the reason that they gave is because there is a chance that women riding chest down would have a higher chance of developing breast cancer.
Oh, my God.
Breast cancer?
They did have one day a year. It was Ladies' Day.
Oh, I hate them.
Yeah. I was so excited to root for the tobogganers of St. Moritz.
So when I hit this 73 miles per hour number, I was pretty confident that the speed was good. But again, I wasn't sure if it would pass the sort of time muster.
Once you have electric contacts that you're hitting with the blades of your runners, that does feel like we've hit a technological point where we're like, this doesn't really feel like it anymore. But if they were doing that for, you know, a couple decades before they just figured out how to measure the speed... Yeah, I could go for it.
Well, and I took this as an indication of how fast one can go on a icy track down a steep hill on something with metal runners, right? And interestingly enough, I did find this other fascinating older example, which is that do any of you know where the roller coaster comes from?
No, I thought some guy invented it.
So the precursor just was that it?
That was a slow burn.
Yeah, that was good. Okay, so the precursor to the roller coaster was something that translates in English into Russian mountain. Catherine the Great, during the mid-1700s, basically in Russia at this point, they used to build these massive towers, huge ice slides, and then people would go down them. And the stories that people told from those are pretty similar in terms of people just like whizzing for a half mile once they hit the bottom of these curves. There was one that I read, I think, was 200 feet tall, this tower that went down an ice slide. later, Catherine the Great actually was like, hey, we should do this during the summertime, and threw wheels on it, and it became the first roller coaster.
That's why she's great.
The Spanish word for roller coaster is montaña rusa, and I've never known why.
Russian mountain.
Yeah. So due to acceleration from gravity, to get over 55 miles an hour is about a 104-foot free fall.
So with the friction and with the slight angle,
it's possible a 200-foot roller coaster would get you over 55.
That's what I'm going with right now.
Hey, we're debating the final, and I haven't given my final. The rope swing. Quintessential human experience, right?
Yeah, I think the rope swing's been around a long time.
Ready?
That is a great feeling, which is not limited to any time or place. I would say the human heart sings when you're on a swing and then you release and you drop into the water.
This is John Oxendorf. He is a professor of architecture and engineering at MIT. He studies the mechanical strength of ancient building techniques.
Cool job.
My question, so we know that swings are a thing, right? We have images of swings going all the way back to ancient Greece. Like, people have figured out how to swing on things. The question then is, would it be possible to construct a swing big enough to go faster than our benchmarks that we've been setting here? So let's just say the horse, 55 miles an hour. So I called up John because he has studied Peruvian rope bridges.
Ooh,
I like where this is going.
The longest one that I have found exists in a remote region of Peru today, and it's 150 feet or about 50 meters. And by comparison, the longest free span achieved by Roman engineers in ancient Rome is about 100 feet. Up until 150 feet, they were able to build ropes strong enough to cross a canyon. And these were also strong enough to carry horses and cannons when the Spanish arrived in the high Andes Mountains in 1532.
Objectively cool, that is.
Yeah.
Very cool.
So 150-foot span. Easily they were able to build these ropes. There's still one Peruvian rope bridge today that is being rebuilt every single year by the two villages on either side. They come together. They weave them together. They're made of grass. The whole village comes together. They make these giant sort of cables, and one bridge consists of six of them, and then they weave in between them with smaller fibers. John has taken one of these grass ropes, tested it to failure, and it can hold about 2 tons, so it could lift a car.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Grass ropes, 2 tons. So clearly you could build a big enough rope to make a pretty big swing. From there, I took this to a pendulum calculator, which you can easily find online, to figure out how high you would have to, what angle you'd have to jump from, and how high you'd have to jump from on your 150-foot long rope in order to get above 55 miles an hour. Thoughts, guesses?
Wow, 150 feet, right?
Yeah.
This is the length.
So a 90-degree angle would be level with the point that you're swinging from.
Right.
I'm just picturing people doing this like thousands of years ago, just like, hey, what are you guys doing on Sunday?
Yeah, a bunch of us are going up to the dome. You know?
Yeah. Well, so I won't make you speculate anymore. To get on a 150-foot rope, to get a swing that goes faster than 55 miles an hour, you'd have to be at a 75-degree angle, 111 feet up. That is a huge jump.
It's massive.
That's like you stand at the top and you're like, nope, I'm not going to do that because I would die.
But how would you erect this swing? Because you would have to have already been over to the other side.
There'd have to be something in like the middle.
Yeah.
I don't even know.
And
I don't even know.
You could like slam into the side of the mountain if you got it wrong.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think the survivability thing, I don't believe it.
Yeah, I think it is theoretically possible, but I think that there's no evidence that a swing this big existed, probably because one did not exist.
Well, let's go through them. So it's the sperm whale. Is the lowest, 6 to 10 miles an hour. Although I think probably they did go 25 miles an hour.
Yeah, me too.
Then it's the Viking rowers, around either 14 or 30.
Yep.
And then what comes after that?
Horses.
Horses are 55.
55 at max, 50 on a good day.
Yeah, let's say that.
fin whale also potentially around
just
50.
Just above horses, I think.
Just notching in right above the ancient horses.
I would say that notching in just below.
And then after that.
I think this is where we'd stick the less dangerous version of Sam's hypothetical swing.
Gotcha. So then after that, ice boating. Depending on the era, though, ice boating was either 30-ish or 60 miles an hour. And then we have luges.
If we count it.
I think my big takeaway is people were able to go really fast. Like much faster than I expected them to be able to go on the rig.
One of my big takeaways here is that the Mongolian people domesticated horses, invented skiing, and launched the first plague corpses over a wall.
I know. Speed
they
freaks.
Really, they really had it going on.
It really got around.
Yeah.
That's it for Word of Mouth this week. This week's show was produced by me, Erica Janik, with Ben Henry, Jackie Helbert, Daniela Ali, Sam Evans-Brown, Nick Capodice, Taylor Quimby, and Justine Paradise. Outside In's theme song is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.